Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme.
To Today on the podcast, we are joined by the brilliant Spencer Lodge. He's an entrepreneur, a business strategist and investor, an award-winning podcast host and top 100 most influential people in Dubai. He's absolutely brilliant and we are thrilled that he's on the show with us today. Spencer, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Now, I'm returning the favour because I recently went on your amazing podcast and had a great chat with you, and that's how I connected with you. For those of you who don't know who you are, what you do, can you tell them a little bit more about yourself?
Within the limits of 20 minutes.
20 minutes, no. I think I struggle with this answering this question because I don't look at what I do with any glee or amazement. It's just what I do. It's just me being me. But I'm just someone that failed at everything basically, and then found something I was good at and got really good at it, and was able to make a career out of it. And that led me on to doing different things. So I was just a kid that failed everything at school, didn't go to uni, got into sales, was taught really well by professional salespeople how to sell, and realized how important it was in business. Then got into the world of wealth management, was able to build a business, exit that business, build another business. And I've been able to build a number of businesses over the years that kind of like I've got wealth management and insurance and well-being and corporate wellness and stuff attached to it. And that's kind of like professionally my background. Apart from that, I'm crazy about my podcast and I'm crazy about the people that I meet on the podcast. But I've also been fortunate enough to make a documentary about human trafficking, which really came from guests on the podcast. And so that's been kind of like the fun part of the last 5 years.
Wow, yeah, it's interesting amazing. You sort of say about failure, because obviously we kind of perceive failure as being such a negative thing, but actually, you know, human nature means that we need failure. We need to fall over so we know how to get back up. And it's interesting you sort of, you know, using the word failure, because obviously it's led you to doing lots of amazing things.
Well, I think I was taught about rejection more than I was taught about failure. I was taught to understand how important rejection is and to seek rejection, because it's only after rejection you find acceptance. It's almost like look for the no's and you'll find the yeses. And so I made it, you know, as a young person, I made it my business to go find people to say no to me. And not allow that to impact me. Whereas I've seen so many people in the world of business and in life as well, just that are so fearful of rejection, and it pains them so much. And it's almost like they take it personally, that it paralyzes them, or at least stops them from doing a lot of the things that they need to do or could do, because they then create stories around that as well. And that's just such a negative spiral to get involved with, I think.
I just want to go back to what you said about how you sort of first started in sales, because I think everything in life is about psychology. I think if we can understand psychology, our own psychology, other people's psychology, and we kind of work with how we think and how we behave and vice versa, then actually we can probably be pretty successful in life, actually, I think. So I think psychology is the basis of everything. And I'm interested in the psychology of sales, because I think that's got a lot of parallels with how you negotiate in relationships, how you negotiate with friendships, generally how you negotiate with yourself. Tell us about the skills you learn in sales and kind of maybe what that has then allowed you to do further on in your career, or how you've used those skills.
Well, I think that the assumption is that sales is talking, and sales isn't. Sales is literally trying to understand somebody by asking them really intelligent questions, try and understand where their pain points are, whether that's commercially or privately, personally, and seeing if what you do provides a solution to those pain points. And so, you know, I was selling office equipment in the city, you know, EC3 in London was my patch. I was going to banks and law firms and insurance companies and flogging these great big machines, but not everyone wants a photocopier, you know, not everyone wants a fax machine, or doesn't need one right now. So 99% of the people that you met actually weren't in the market for what you were selling. But with smart questioning and trying to understand problems that they experience and the ways that you potentially could solve those problems, it meant that more people would say yes than say no. So I learned that in sales, it was about questions, solve people's problems, bring solutions to them. And what you'll find is that you can do business together based upon that. that then enabled me to get into financial services. And when I got into financial services, I really got passionate about people not making big mistakes with money. And the first thing I saw is that people had credit card debt that they were paying off slowly, not realizing how much interest they were paying. And it, you know, that annoyed me. It annoyed me that the credit card companies weren't telling people in enough detail, and that people weren't understanding their own finances in enough detail to manage it. So I kind of got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about that. Then I also got a bee in my bonnet about how the world went from everyone having a company pension and working for a company for a long time, like my dad did, to people not having that, but then not contributing to a private pension because they were trying to work out some form of shortcut, get rich quick, I'm going to build it in real estate or whatever it may be solution, and ending up at the age of 65 without enough money. And the reality is, when you're 65 and you don't have enough money, you believe that you'll just carry on working. But the truth is, who wants to employ a 65-year-old? Not really many people do. You know, if we could employ two 30-year-olds for the price of one 65-year-old, we'd probably choose that. They've got twice as much energy and twice as much dynamicism in them. And so it's like, if you get to 65 and you don't have enough money, what can you do? You've got three choices. You can rob a bank. And, you know, most people...
We wouldn't recommend that on this podcast, by the way.
No, well, at the end of the day, if you see me in a balaclava, I look a little bit silly. So they'd probably laugh at me if I went into a bank with a balaclava on. In actually, a pair of tights.
A bit cold outside, yeah.
Give us your money. And why have you got your mum's tights on? Anyway, so... you can win the lottery, but you've got more chance of getting struck by lightning than winning a lottery. So probably come and have a chat with me once you've been struck by lightning, then we can talk about your chances.
Yeah.
Or you can save and plan for it. They're kind of like three options to get there. And going to work at 65 onwards really isn't an option, because you can't guarantee your health. You can't guarantee, you know, your ability to do something. So I got really passionate about bulletproofing people from these financial lifetime decisions. And because I got really passionate about it, I had an enormous amount of conviction around it. And so I knew my subject, and I was so sure on my matters related to tax and finance and stuff that if I had a conversation with anyone, 9 times out of 10, I could find a way to help them. Even if they had enough money, I then had the ability to say, well, are you doing the best things with the money that you've created along the way? And so that became kind of like a big part of my work, you know, and what I did. And I cared greatly about solving that problem for many people. And then, you know, I became an entrepreneur in 2012. You know, never before. I was an intrapreneur. I worked within a business and helped grow it. But becoming an entrepreneur was a whole different ballgame. It was just understanding that, you know, business isn't about selling financial services. It's about accounts and marketing and compliance and all these other weird things that I didn't really understand. But I'm good at two things. One is I'm good at sales, but number two, I'm really good at finding good people and giving them opportunities to make them loyal to, you know, the shared mission and vision that we have. And so, you know, my business partner Danielle joined me when she was 19 years old. She's now the CEO and a business partner. She's 38 years old. So she's 19 years of her life. She's been with me. I've been nearly all of her career. But I know how to find good people. And it's maybe a sixth sense I have, I don't know, but I know how to find good people. And that's always been something that's worked well with me.
I love that. And I think, you know, the more I talk to different people who've been successful in their area of life, or who are happy, or who are fulfilled, actually it comes down, I think, a lot to relationships and leadership, in terms of, like you say, finding good people, finding the right people, finding people you trust. And then, you know, you treat them well, you're straightforward, you're honest with them. And then they are then, like I say, loyal to you. And then you build that really, really strong team. And I think teams, strong teams, resilient teams, and authentic teams are probably one of the mainstays in business, or at least successful businesses anyway. I mean, what you tend to find is with any place that doesn't have that, things fall apart pretty quickly. And you get lots of toxicity within a workplace or organisation. Which leads me on to your work in the sort of the corporate world, workplace wellbeing, understanding employers and what they need. That's been an area which has grown a lot, I think, over the last sort of 5-6 years. Just tell us about your reflections, or why did you kind of get into that? What was your remit for that, and what kind of led you there?
But at the beginning of the journey, there were some rules here in Dubai where I live that had changed, or some that we would think in the UK are a little bit mad. So we have something in the UK called the Good Samaritan Law. And that basically means if we're walking down the high street, somebody falls over, has a heart attack, any one of us is allowed to jump on that person if we know what to do, give chest compressions mouth to mouth and help save that life. And over here, that didn't exist. And so if that happened, and it did, there was a French guy that did it to a local lady and saved her life, but he was deported because he didn't have the right to save her life. Even though he didn't have the right to. And it was like, wow, that's just nuts over here. If something, I would want to know if I keeled over and something happened to me, I was in a car crash, somebody, you know, who, if they knew what to do, could try and do something. So that kind of led me on then to an experience I had where I was on a football pitch. It was Tuesday night on an AstroTurf in the back of a school where 20, 40 somethings, professionals, accountants, lawyers, this kind of stuff, would basically have a kickabout and call it football, an exercise. And there was a lad that came to join us, and he was playing in the hour after we played. He said, can he come and play with us? He was 23. We were like, yeah, go for it. Anyway, he played with us. And then after about 10 minutes, he fell over. And so we carried on playing. And so eventually we wandered over to see him, and someone shouted, he's having an epileptic fit. Well, I have a friend who's epileptic, so I know what to do. And so I jumped on him, turned him into the recovery position, got his tongue out of his mouth, made sure that his airway was clear. Okay. While he was going through his fit. And again, I know exactly what to do in that moment. And then I was like, I'm not sure he is. And then he took this almighty gulp of air, you know, and I was like, it's not an epileptic fit, guys. This is not, get the ambulance now. So we called the ambulance, and, you know, some 20 minutes later, a helicopter actually came because of the traffic and landed on the footy pitch. They took him away, and thank goodness, you know, they treated him and he was off and safe off to hospital. And we called the next day just to make sure he was okay. And we found out that he died. And he was a 23-year-old kid that had a heart attack. And I could have saved him if I knew what to do. If I knew chest compressions, if I knew mouth to mouth, if I knew that first aid trained, then surely I could have done something about it. And there were 20 guys my age, we were all 40-year-olds at the time, that all in professional jobs, and none of us knew what to do. It was, I hope he's okay, you know, while we wait for this ambulance. The guy was having a heart attack. So it was a real shock to my system, frightened the life out of me. I then went on and learned about first aid, and we got involved in creating, and again, Danielle, my business partner, must take the credit for this. We got involved in creating campaigns where we went into schools to talk to parents about what would happen if these kind of things happened to your kids. Are you equipped to deal with this kind of stuff? And we went then into nurseries as well, and we realized that lots of people weren't equipped. And we also realized that they weren't insured as well. So no critical illness, no life insurance. I was like, well, what happens if your husband dies? You know, what happens if this happens and that happens? And people were like, I didn't realize. So this is how this journey really started for us. And we started to get into the world of then companies where we would go in and we would put these workshops on where we'd teach people about first aid and teach them to understand what the rules of the country, what to do and what not to do. And that proved to be hugely successful for our business. Plus, we were doing something good for our community too. We then, with our insurance business as it grew, we started to look at how we could then help companies reduce their medical insurance costs. Now, you've got someone who might be obese or you know, carries all some kinds of issues. What could we do to prevent that? Can we help them, you know, with a nutrition plan? Can we help them with an exercise plan? Can we help them involve them in some way by getting nurses that work for us to test these people to find out the problems so that they can be then addressed and then reduce their medical insurance costs? And that was a great thing to do. But what we started to look at as time went by is there were problems in companies that were much bigger than that. You have a HR department and you have a CFO or finance. The CFO doesn't like spending money, okay? He wants to make profit. The HR department wants to focus on employee well-being. They care greatly that everyone's happy. The CFO is looking at the bottom line, HR looking at solutions, but they don't generally tend to marry. There's always this kind of push and shove. You know, if we do this and if we do that, we know it's better for the business. And the CFO's like, how better? How better exactly? If I spend this money, what do I get back? And they weren't able always to explain that in a way that made sense. So we decided that we would look at how we could bridge that gap, how we could go into companies and look at what the problems were and try and find solutions for them. And some of the things we found is that financial stress is a massive problem for employees, workplace stresses. And so how do we deal with stress? Lots of companies will have the pizzas on a Friday or once a month, or they'll take the team on a team building day out into the blooming forest to go on ropes and ladders and stuff. You know, this is what we do. Or for the top performers, they'll take them to the races once a year and they'll go and get drunk on the back of a double-decker bus and, watch the Epsom Derby or whatever it may be. And so it was like, let's look at this from a business point of view. How can we make the business more profitable? That was the focus. So if we can help the business understand ways they can be more profitable and they lean into wellness, then you've got a win-win situation with your HR, your employees, plus your finance team. And so that's really how that started to come about. And Danielle, my business partner, then went into a number of companies and just investigated over and over and over and over again, okay, what the problems could be. And we'd been gathering like official data on this for about 8 years. And then it was like, what are the solutions? Here's the solutions. How can we deal with it? Let's implement it through whichever strategy we deployed, and then in turn, help the company become more profitable and have the employees much happier. And a good example of this is one. 20% of all employees in the UAE, where I live, will leave their job this year. That's one in five people. So let's say the three of us own a company, we've got 100 employees, and we lose 20. Now, that could be from across the spectrum. I don't mean, the cleaners. I'm talking about across the spectrum. You lose 20 people, one-fifth of your workforce. Well, first of all, you've got gratuity payments to deal with. Then you've got recruitment fees for recruiters. Then you've got HR departments doing loads of work. Then you've got training and onboarding. And invariably, people don't get going straight away. It takes them a few months to get started. So you've got all of the cost involved in that. The calculation is to replace somebody costs three times the salary of the person that's left. So if someone's earning £50,000 a year, then it's going to cost £150,000 all in to replace that person and get them up and running. Plus, you're probably going to have to pay them a bit more as a salary as well. So why would you want to do that as a business?
It's daft,
you know? You and I have talked about this before, but it's daft. And so it was leaning into that and saying, right, how do we make this much more sense? You know, how does that employee get more connected, that sense of belonging, that sense of purpose and mission that they're in, and make sure that they know what they want to achieve and how they want to achieve it, and the company finds and facilitates a way for them to get there. And so that for us has been kind of like a big body of our work. And as I said, Danielle sat and thought about this long and hard. She's incredibly analytical, and I've got to give her credit for putting that together.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I think, do you feel as well, like going back to the wellness thing, do you think that's still, I mean, it feels like maybe workplaces are getting better, but particularly big corporations, but it feels like that's been a long, slow process of getting that compassionate leadership at the top of a lot of these big brands and businesses.
I think you've got to really compare. How old are you?
Me?
What are you, Joel?
46.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm 53, so we're similar. You remember when we went to work in our 20s?
Yeah.
You know, you're lucky to have a job. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You got your head down, tail up, and you're like, you don't piss the boss off, whatever you do, You're lucky to have a job, so keep your head down, work hard. And if you were unhappy or if you were considering leaving and whatnot, the office didn't know about it. You know, you'd be secretly doing doctor's appointments to go to a recruitment agency to fill some forms. Oh, but the dentist, how many fillings are you actually?
I'm just wondering how many people in the audience are sitting there going, I've done that.
My extra long lunch break. But nowadays it's different to then. It's like the employees seem to have a power they never had before. That's also a problem. Because for me, this is not all about the employers doing all of the work and giving all of the giving. If you sign a contract to say you'll be paid this salary, okay, and your input is this and your output is that, you get 4 weeks holiday, yada, yada, yada. If you sign that contract and you've agreed to it, well, you have some responsibility to live up to and commit and deliver upon the contract you sign. And so we have to remember there's still a responsibility for the employees to behave in the right way. It's not just about pointing the finger at leadership all of the time, toxic management versus empathetic management and stuff like that. And there are also a lot more things now that in the workplace become issues that weren't issues before. You know, well, there were statistics when I was young that was something like 27% of all marriages start in the office. You know, this is like when I was young in my training, 27%, because people met each other at work because we all went to work all hours.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We were there. You know, no one worked from home or took a half day. Like, you're going to work and then 2 weeks in Benidorm and then back again, you know, where you go, that's it, roads. You know, and then you were flash if you had a week skiing. And so it's like you look at it now and I think that we really have to make sure that we understand the responsibilities we have as employees as much as we understand the responsibilities we have as employers, and take that both seriously and don't start to create issues that probably aren't real issues. They're just, you know, a good one is, yeah, but I was offended by what he said. And it's like, okay, you're offended, but were you right? You know, you can't make a song and a dance about everything. You put 10 people, 100 people in a room from different backgrounds, different walks of life. One lost their mum when they were 3 years old. Another one grew up in a council flat. Another one grew up in a pub, you know. Okay. Another one grew up and dad was a vicar, you know. Another one grew up and went to university and another one didn't. They walked on the streets every evening as a latchkey kid because their parents were at work till 8 o'clock at night. All of those things you don't know when you're sat in a room together. Okay, but it means you have different gauges and measures and sensors and different references. You know, a reference is normal for one, may not be normal for another. Yeah, I said I was in the gym training with one of my friends this morning, and he's Egyptian. And I said the word shag. Okay, I said that, and he said to me, "That's that word they use in Austin Powers, isn't it?" I haven't heard that for years.
You make a really good point there, Spencer, because actually I've always found it fascinating in a way that any of us can maintain any form of relationship or friendship whatsoever. Because if you look at, like you said, you take two individuals, we're just talking about two here, not like you said, 50 or 200 in a workplace. You take two individuals, you look at all the different things they've been through, the different contexts of how they've grown up, their thinking patterns, what they've observed their parents doing, what experiences they've had in life, what life traumas they've had, their sort of strategies for getting through things. You take just two people with all those differences and all the different permutations of how they could react in interaction or conversation. I mean, that is, it's pretty extraordinary if you think of all the different permutations of what could happen, that actually we as human beings have friendships and relationships. Obviously, there's the evolutionary side of it where, you know, we're social creatures. We want to be a part of a community and a tribe. So our biology probably takes over some of those issues, but it is quite extraordinary. And I think we don't really frame our workplaces in that context. We don't see them as places where relationships happen. We see them as we go in, we do something, we get money for it. But actually, part of what you're saying is, you know, trying to understand each other, that's kind of two-way relationship between employer and employee, and the fact that both people need to contribute to having a good workplace. You can't just blame one person, just like you can't in an argument between two people who are going out, for example. So I think it's interesting how we frame work and actually how we need to kind of rejig it to sort of see the benefits of work. You know, socialization, meeting people that you might go on a date with. You know, if you're working from home, who are you going to meet? The postman or postwoman who comes to your door, or the delivery driver.
Probably the person my mum met, which is the milkman.
But, there you go. So it's interesting, isn't it, that work brings us so much more than just sort of income, or it can do, if we're wise and clever about it.
Agreed.
Yeah. So tell us about your just listening to your story and your kind of your journey through things, it strikes me that you've reacted very organically to what's happened in your life. And I know none of us, well, some of us think we have a plan for our lives, but it doesn't really seem to work out that way for the majority of us. Plans don't really work out that way. But it strikes me that you've always moved, you've sort of done one thing, something's happened to you, you've thought about it, you've moved into a different area, or it's become quite organic. Would you say you had a plan? Would you say that you wake up every day and have a plan of what you're going to do? Or do you think that you kind of tend to respond and react more to what happens in life and you move with the times?
I'm in the pursuit of happiness and I'm in the avoidance of depression. I think that's the place I'm in, and I find myself in either one of those places. But when I'm in the place of pursuing happiness, generally my path tends to change. I don't have a great attention span, so I need constant stimulation. So I need people to feel connected. You know, people will say an introvert doesn't like to be around people. No, an introvert doesn't like to be around idiots. Now, they like to be around. They like to be around their kind of people.
Yeah,
you know, and an extrovert doesn't need people around them. You know, 9 times out of 10, they're happy talking to themselves in the mirror. So it's. I think that the when I look at what my journey has been, you know, I was successful, made a load of money, and all that kind of stuff, and that was all really good. But it didn't really make me happy, and I became self-destructive because I had more than I knew what to do with. I then pursued other avenues, some successfully, some unsuccessfully. And I think it's really important to remember, because a lot of people think I'm successful, but I've failed at loads of stuff. Okay. And maybe I don't talk about those failures enough, but I've committed some howlers, like some proper howlers, like things that if I told you about them, you'd be like, you did that, you know, so some as daft as investing a bit of money in a friend's business that he then convinced me to invest a much bigger amount. So I invested 50 grand in his business. I then invested 500,000 in that business because he said it was a dead cert, blah, blah, blah. I didn't do my due diligence. I sold an apartment on the River Thames that's now worth 4 million. That I took the money out, sold the apartment and took the equity out and went and invested, and I've lost every penny of it. And so there's stories like this along the way. I've started businesses that I thought were going to be great that ended up not being great. But when it comes to pursuing happiness, I think we should be taught this at school, okay, as a law. You know, there's a few laws I think should come at school that don't, okay, but one of them is go be happy, okay, and focus on whatever makes you happy, because whatever makes you happy, I don't mean your passion, because I think that's so cheesy, but what makes you happy? Because invariably, if it makes you happy, you'll have a greater interest in it. You'll consume more content around it. You'll know more about it. You'll probably be able to deliver in a better way than anybody else. So let's say, I don't know, Formula One makes you happy. Okay. Well, notice people that love Formula One. They spend, you know, the time on their phones. They look at their who they're following on Instagram, look at who they're, what stuff they're consuming on YouTube. It's all related to something that they care about. And I think that if we spend our time focused on happiness, we'd get a long way. But the trouble is, every young person thinks that money equals success. Every young person thinks that going up the steps of the ladder on the career path means success. They're taught to understand that buying your first home means some sex success. Having a family and getting married and having kids is success. And the truth is, it's not. Okay, it's nonsense. But I've tried as hard as I can to try and talk young people out of some of those things, but they ain't listening. No different to me. I wasn't listening. So I think we all have to go on a bit of a journey then to look back and realize, was it as good as I thought it was? And that means then we all have mistakes, because we all have regrets from some of the decisions we made that weren't maybe the best ones. As we go on later in life, we start to realize that maybe we haven't got an infinite amount of time. And if there's things that we want to do in life, that we should start getting ourselves organized to do them. And whether that's climbing Mount Everest or spending more time with our kids, decisions are for every individual to choose. But for me, it's happiness. I want to be happy. I know what depression feels like. I know what suicidal thoughts feel like. I want to be happy and I need it. And for a drug addict on cocaine or heroin, happiness is the drug I'm pursuing.
Wow, that's powerful. That really is powerful. It reminds me of a book that I read, which is called Siddhartha, which is about the life of Buddha. And it's a very small book. And I read it actually in about sort of 2 or 3 hours, because it was just it was amazing. I loved it. And basically through his life, he tries all of these different things at different phases of his life. So he kind of looks at money, and then looks at relationships, and looks at this, that, and the other, to find happiness, to find himself in those things. And the very last sort of chapter is him as an old man sitting by a stream, and he finally realizes that actually that is what makes him happy. And it's almost like you said, it's sort of full cycle of when he was small and then when he was older, and trying all of these different avenues to find what he's looking for. And then he realizes that it was already there. It was there all the way along, which I think is just beautiful. So thank you so much for sharing that, because I think that's really helpful for people to hear. I just want to touch
Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. And it's kind of like one of those books in the world that the whole world needs to read. And it's like, it's just like, it should be. Why are we reading Cider with Rosie? You know, why are we doing that? The Hobbit. Why are we doing The Hobbit in our English class at school? Gee, man, get Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. I mean, learn that shit when you're a kid. I mean, that's powerful stuff. Alchemist, Paulo Coelho. Learn that, you know. Why do we need to be doing...
There's a copy behind me of that book.
But it's like, why are they teaching us this stuff in school? It's just like, you know, you come out of school and you understand what meaning and purpose and these kind of things are. It's just like, imagine what kind of young people we'd create. I mean,
Giles is an author, and you've written loads of books, haven't you, Giles, for children?
Nothing like Viktor Frankl, though, unfortunately.
No, but you know the power of writing books.
Yeah, well, storytelling, children. I think, you know, we all want to hear like stories and, you know, storytelling in general. I think, you know, we're all on our own journeys and stories ourselves. And I guess it's about creating the right story for yourself and finding the right plot twists. And sometimes there are plot twists that you're not expecting, but it's dealing with those.
So, Spencer, just to finish off, if it's that one thing that kind of people listening, they might have forgotten about, maybe they've kind of got a bit lost, a bit delusional, a bit kind of in a sense of disillusionment about life, for their health and well-being, what would that one thing be, do you think, that people should try to remember or reconnect with?
So it's an important question, but I wonder sometimes whether it's that one thing. I learned about a word that I poo-pooed for many years, and the word was gratitude. And I learned about it a few years ago, and I've kind of heard these people, gratitude and attitude, and have an attitude of gratitude, and you know, this kind of like, be thankful, be grateful, don't forget how lucky you are type of stuff. And I'd be like, oh, shut up, you know, you make the life you want to make. And you know, people, I'm journaling what I'm grateful for at the end of every day. I'm going to write down on my book. What I, you know, I'm like, and I used to think, come on. And then I spent some time with somebody who I really respected and really valued. And we were sitting having dinner one night, and he said to me, and he just out of the blue, you know, he's an older man than me. He said, so how often do you write in your gratitude journal? And I looked at him and I went, and in a split second, I nearly bullshitted and lied. And then I just came clean. I was just like, I don't have a gratitude journal. And he was like, what? Why would you not have it? He said, so what are you grateful for? And I was kind of, well, I'm grateful. And I gave him kind of vanilla surface things. Yeah. Like, I'm grateful for that. Yeah. He's like, no, but what are you really grateful for? He said, because unless we understand gratitude and remind ourselves how important it is to focus on that, the alternative can be very dark. You can't be unhappy when you're grateful. You can't be depressed when you're grateful. And so I would urge everyone just to stop and remember, okay, why they're here, what in their life they're grateful for. And that could be a family member, that could be a grandparent, that could be a child, that could be an inspirational leader they work for, that could be the guy that teaches their kids how to play football or gymnastics. It could be the person that did a beautiful flower bouquet for them when they wanted to take a gift for a friend recently and engage in a warm conversation. It could be the taxi driver that made you laugh because he kept blowing his nose or whatever it was on the way to the meeting. Or it can be for fresh air and something so simple. But to me, it's like when I was a kid, my mum used to say to me, eat your food. And I was like, but I don't like Brussels sprouts. And she goes, there's people that don't ever get Brussels sprouts. And I work now through the documentary that I created and the people I work with here in Dubai, I work with a group of Bangladeshi children who my worst ever day is beyond the wildest dreams of their best ever day. And I can't tell you how much of an impact that on its own has on my life. I was with them last weekend, as I'm with them very often. I find it very hard to be unemotional around them. I find it very hard not to feel their pain and suffering. But I also focus on reminding myself how lucky I am. We went to a roadside cafe to go and buy them lunch. And the lady that I work with, Maria, she said to me, this is like Christmas Day for them. Thank you. And it just reminds me that the world is full of pain. Be very grateful for what you've got. And if you can be kind to people in some small way, somehow, I just think the world would be a lot better. And if there was a revolution and everyone in the world had a responsibility to be kind to one person every day, everything would change.
Wow. That was a beautiful way to end the podcast. Thank you so much, Spencer, for joining us. You are incredible. I've loved chatting to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.